Proverbs 10. Proverbs 10 and 4 says, "He becometh poor that dealeth with a slack hand, but the hand of the diligent maketh rich." Now, I should have mentioned to you last night that what I'm going to be covering tonight is on the third page of the outline I gave you last night, practicing financial responsibility. And the handout that you were given tonight, if you don't happen to have one, there's probably some still at the back, called A Working Budget. And this is just some additional material to stress yourself over. I remember one woman said that she thought a budget was a husband's plan to punish her. Well, it all depends on who's the spender and who's the saver in the family. And it isn't always the same one, either the husband or wife. Now, last night I was focusing on the spiritual issues concerning our financial stewardship. And those issues are very, very important. The reality that it is important whether we are coveting or contented, whether we are living in the atmosphere of love, and who we love, what we love. Basically, there's a little saying that whatever you love controls you, and there's a lot of truth to that statement. The issue of our faith, that's tremendously important. Our trust in God tells him what we think of him better than anything else. And so, because money and possessions can become a substitute for God in the hearts, in the affections, and in the confidence of people, it's not surprising that the Lord actually talked more about money than he did about heaven in the recorded utterances in the Gospels. And he raises some very strong issues of our relationship to money. And so tonight I want to get into the practical handling of money as we earn income and so on. And I forgot to mention a quote last night that I think is very, very important. And it comes from a man named Larry Burkett, who was a Christian counselor who passed away a number of years ago. And he made this interesting statement that the way we spend our money is the clearest outside indicator of our spiritual values. Now, when I read that, that was kind of like a shock. I think we have the tendency to separate our spiritual life from our financial life. We don't always see the important connection that exists. But his claim is that how we spend our money is actually the clearest outside indicator of our spiritual values. Now, that's kind of a sobering thing. So I want to think with you about being diligent, being disciplined in life, and the benefits of it. And so, the number one, and this is just in the introduction here, the number one financial practice that will be a benefit to you is simply to always practice positive cash flow. Now, do you know what cash flow is? That's some kind of a chart or a graph. It's often shown that way, where you have your income flowing in and then all the expenses and where you spend your money, it's all flowing out, the cash flow. Positive cash flow is saying always spend less than you earn and do it for the rest of your life. Some people have captured that sense with a slogan, pay yourself first. And many, many financial advisors and so on, they will say, and they will take a 10%, which is a pretty high amount for a lot of people, and they say, take it and put it away. For many people, the only way that's going to work is to have an automatic debit on your account. And whatever you set aside, it doesn't have to be 10%. That might be unrealistic for you. But that idea of setting aside something for savings and buffer, and I at least read this, that even if you hate budgeting, don't ever intend to budget, even if you did that much, took 10%, set it aside for future savings, you would do all right. You would manage. You would learn to live on what you've got left. And this is why so many of us get into payments for everything, because you make your payment. I don't know how many times when I've talked to people about, you know, buying a car or whatever, and they say, well, you know, I could never save up to buy a car. Well, most of us don't seem to be able to. But what you will do is you will go out and buy a car and put it on payments, and you will be saving up for a car in reverse. The only problem is, instead of you earning interest while you're saving, you're spending interest while you're paying. And what happens is when we get into this framework of always buying and paying later, we're always working against a headwind, as you might say. We're always working against that cost, that additional cost that's built into everything else we do, because we don't have that money. It's obligated. And so, you know, budgeting sometimes doesn't seem like much fun. It's a lot more fun getting into debt, spending it. But it's only momentary. And actually, budgeting and being disciplined in this way actually in the long term means freedom. And it enables us to become better stewards of what God has committed to us. I'll just give you one example. I was giving some of this teaching in my own home assembly a number of years ago, and a brother who was a very godly brother, he's one of the elders there now. And when I was actually giving the example that's in the working budget on home buying strategies, and there's Sam Small and Bill Bake. After the meeting, he came back. When I came back, he says, well, he says, I'm Bill Big. Well, he has an excellent job, excellent career, but he went and got the biggest mortgage that he could get. And he says, I'm doing great financially. I have nothing to complain about, but everything I've got is obligated. And the reason why it had hit him was because his own brother lost his job. And he was saying, here I am, so well provided by the Lord, but because I have obligated myself right to the hilt, I can't even help my own brother. He recognized that his choice financially was hindering him in being a steward to care for the need that had arisen of his own brother. And so the hindrances to good stewardship: materialism and easy credit. Materialism, as I mentioned last night, is simply the preoccupation with material things and trying to satisfy our beings from the material world. And it doesn't ever work. There are some satisfactions, pleasures, enjoyments of things, but as soon as we set our heart on it to be the satisfaction of our life, it just becomes a bondage. And easy credit is the one thing in particular that has created the circumstances that we find ourselves in today, financially, as nations, as whole economies. We are living in debt-funded economies, credit-funded economies, and there is a price to pay. We don't know yet what that price is going to be. And the number one mistake, materialistic lifestyle, spending more than you earn. Number two mistake is no budget, no planning. And so you tend to buy impulsively or responsively as you see things or as needs come up, then you buy things and then you worry about paying for them after. And the number three mistake, now some of this I don't remember exactly where I got this from, but I'm not sure if it was Larry Burkett's writings or another financial counselor named Ron Blue. I have appreciated material from both of those authors. The number three mistake is automobile purchases. And so I'll try to touch on a little bit of that later. Now, how important is budgeting? Well, that's why I read in Proverbs 10 and 4, where we can become poor. In fact, I'll say this, that we today have the ability to be both rich and poor at the same time. Many of us have so much more than the vast majority of people living in the world. If you've ever gone to another country and spent some time there, sometimes I remember after my brother David went to Chile as a missionary, and this is going back 30 years ago now, and my wife and I and my parents all went down for a visit. We spent a couple of months there, and it was actually a culture shock coming back home and just looking at what we have in comparison to even the country of Chile, which is relatively modern and relatively doing well as far as South American countries. We have been so much blessed. We have so much. And yet, we can be stressed. We can be so indebted. And I remember this is going back again more than, well, it was 1986 when I saw this quote in a Focus on the Family article. And this was, I don't know how much better or worse it is today, but it says that in the United States, if you cashed out the average 65-year-old man, who basically is at the end of his working life, if you cashed him out, took all his assets, and then all his liabilities and added it up, he would be worth about $100. Now, if that is true, that is terribly, terribly tragic. At the end of a working life, to be just breaking even. When you're approaching the years when you're going to have needs that you yourself may not be able to meet. And so one of the big aspects that we need to think about is not just living for the moment, living for now, but recognizing there is a time period of our life when we're going to need to coast on what we have accumulated previously. And so budgeting is something that enables some of that to be able to be done. Another thing I remember given, this is just another comment about how we, in our culture, and certainly it has been my generation, comparison to my father's generation, and now my son's generation in comparison to me is probably a little bit, somewhat on the same line, where a young couple starting out often accumulates in the first 3 years of marriage what it should take them 30 years to accumulate. And what it may have taken their parents 30 years to accumulate. So basically what happens is, and this is one of the side effects of progress, is that we raise our children and give them the best we can, and they want to start out where we left off and don't realize how long it takes and the discipline of life it takes to actually get there and own it yourself. And so on this page, there is a suggested financial formula. And I didn't put it there just to confuse you more, because this has nothing to do with the working budget. It's a totally different budget idea than the one that I have on the other sheets. Now, this was actually in a book by Chuck Swindoll, and it was a book about marriage. And the reason why he put it in his book on marriage is simply because financial problems account for about 50% of the marital breakups. Tensions, conflicts, that develop because of financial pressure has ruined probably half of the marriages that have broken up. So it is a very, very significant issue to think about. Now, in this suggested financial formula, it's called the 10-70-20 plan, you have, first of all, total earnings, and then you take off from that what you determine within your own heart to give to the Lord. And I should make a few comments. I really didn't get onto this last night on the subject of giving. I believe personally, and my wife and I have practiced this, that, and again, my income comes in bits and pieces here and there. I never know from month to month how much I'm receiving. So it's impossible for us to say, well, we're going to give to the Lord a fixed amount, so we base it on a percentage amount. So as gifts of fellowship come in, we simply have a certain percentage that we always deduct and put into a little envelope downstairs, and that is what we call the Lord's money. Now, as I taught you last night, it's all the Lord's money. It's all the Lord's money. But this is what we are devoting to give back to the Lord for His purposes. Why is that significant or important? Well, the Old Testament talked about a tithe. The New Testament does not use the tithe directly. But there is a somewhat parallel concept taught in the New Testament. And if you go to 2 Corinthians 8 and 9, there are two chapters taken up with the idea of giving. So it is not an insignificant or unspiritual thing to contemplate. Your money is just as sacred as anything else in your life. It belongs in your worship. And so to give to the Lord is an expression of appreciation that we receive everything from Him. Everything we have is from His hand. And so to return something to Him is an appropriate expression of our thanksgiving and our worship to Him. It is also an expression of our trust, that we are confident that we can give to Him and we're not going to be the losers for it. The Lord has a far bigger hand than I do, a far bigger heart than I have. And so that is part of the basic primary principle. There's some very important concepts taught in 2 Corinthians 8 and 9. I would just encourage you to look through it. And as far as where you distribute it and disperse it, most of us who are in assembly fellowship, we recognize that what is given week by week, the reason that that is done is actually drawn from 1 Corinthians chapter 16. There's a reference to that idea of laying by in store something weekly. And so there's nothing wrong with this kind of a disciplined approach to giving to the Lord and not simply waiting until something happens and you are called upon to give to the Lord. In fact, really the best way of looking at it is that what you set aside week by week or biweekly, however you get paid, you are there devoting it to the Lord, and then as opportunity comes and as emergencies arise, well, then it can be dispersed for that need. And so the Lord, and then government taxes, and most people who work out, all of that's taken off before they ever see the check, so you don't have to worry about the government. They will take their taxes one way or the other. The working money is then, again, savings and investments, 10%, and that is long-term savings, and that can include pension plans and registered retirement plans and so on. And then 70% to all living expenses, and then 20% to the repayment of debts and what is called a buffer fund, that is saving up for emergencies. Now, if you look at that, you'll probably decide that that's a long ways off. And again, this is just, you might say, a goal to steer your ship towards. And direct your budgeting and so on towards that kind of a goal. Now, I want to take some time to talk to you directly about credit. Let's go to Romans chapter 13. Romans chapter 13. A familiar verse in verse 8. Owe no man anything but to love one another, for he that loveth another has fulfilled the law. Now, if you look at this verse in the context of Romans 13, he has been talking about government ministries, government administration, and the necessity of them being supported. And so it says in verse 6, pay tribute. Verse 7, render to all their dues, tribute to whom tribute, custom to whom custom, fear to whom fear, honor to whom honor. And so the passage is actually a little wider in context than just talking about you borrowing some money from somebody. It is talking about paying your obligations, meeting your obligations. And so I'm not going to tell you that it is sin or wrong to borrow money. What this is emphasizing is that whatever you owe, pay it. Meet your obligations. Fulfill your contractual obligations. But I will say this, that credit has become a great curse. And excessive borrowing is one of the things that has destroyed individuals and families. And so I don't take it lightly either. So owe no man anything but to love one another. Why does he say that? Well, simply he's saying this. Any other kind of debt or obligation, you can pay it off. You can free yourself from it, but you will never, never be free from the obligation to love others. That is something we will never be able to pay off and have no more accountability. In other words, I will never be able to come to the point where I say, I don't owe you anything. I will always owe you the interest and care that love puts me under as an obligation. Now, types of credit. There's mortgages, there's secured lines of credit, there are loans for for cars, for renovations, loans for vacations. There's that plastic that seems to be so abundant today of credit cards. And what is the problem with credit? Well, very simply, what credit does is it blurs the relationship between your decision and its consequences. Now, if you were to, just to say, for the next 3 months, I am only going to live on a cash basis, and you go to the store and you see that and it catches your eye and you think, boy, I'd like to have that. And you remember, no, I can't, because I need this money for this month. But with a credit card, it's no problem. As long as the limit hasn't been reached yet, as long as there's room on it, you can do it. And we think in terms of monthly payment affordability rather than cash amount availability. And so it blurs the consequence, but at the same time, it multiplies the consequence. You're going to pay more. And you're going to pay it over and over again. Researchers have found that when people use a credit card, they will spend, on average, 34% more than when they are not using a credit card. So that's a good enough reason why they keep sending along those invitations to you to have a new credit card. And they'll give you an enticing low interest rate, usually for 6 months or a few months. And then it jumps up to, I don't know, one I have is somewhere around 18% or 18.8%. You know, it's an amazing thing how they can get away with that, because that's about the rate it was when the bank lending rates were at 8% and 9% and that kind of thing. And now that banks are basically giving money away, credit is down at historic lows, yet credit card rates are still up there. It's almost extortion. Now, the thing that I guess bothers me about it, that irritates me, is that I'm paying for the effect of credit, whether I use it or not. What I'm getting at is this. Credit, easy credit, what I call easy credit, has had a tremendous inflationary effect upon living costs. Now, if you were just to ask yourself, what would the price of a car be if people couldn't borrow money to buy a car? What price would it be? Well, it never would have gotten to the prices they are today. It would have been restrained by the buying power. But easy credit increases that buying power, in a sense, artificially. And the net effect is that it creates more demand and enables the prices to rise. The same thing on the grand scale is houses. And it just is inevitable that house prices have to correct at some point, because young people starting out are not going to be able to buy a house. And that is why we have seen this effect, because we've been seeing cycles of the inflationary effect of credit. That's why now we are down at the bottom point of this whole process, where interest rates are being kept at a bottom, almost nil. And people are still getting to the place where they can barely afford to buy what's being offered. I don't think very many people realize how significant this all is. It means that either interest rates have to be kept this low for the next generation at least, or prices of real estate, houses, is going to have to come down drastically. You may not believe this, but the first house that I bought, that I borrowed for, interest rates were at 16% for a mortgage. And in the next couple of years, they actually went up about as high as about 18%. Now you can imagine what that did. It would be a very worthwhile thing, a sobering thing, for you to get out of a financial calculator. You can look at, there's all kinds of them online and so on, where you plug in the cost. As each percentage on a $100,000 mortgage, as each percentage goes up on a 15-year loan and a 25-year loan, I should have brought it with me tonight. I had it at somewhere. I forgot to put it in. You'll see the increase of how much more you're paying every percentage of increase. What that means is if the banks are forced to begin raising interest rates, there's a lot of people who are just about here are going to be underwater. And so it's a very sad reality, sobering reality. Now, an appropriate limit for credit. I remember going in to a bank with a sister who had asked me to help her out, to advise her. She had never bought a house before. She had a good job. She was a school teacher. But when she went in there, the bank manager, or the loans officer, basically asked her what her monthly gross income was. Now, her net take-home pay was significantly different. There were a lot of deductions. They have a heavy-duty pension plan with the teachers in Ontario. And what she had to live on was didn't bear much relationship to what it looked like on paper. But he never asked her any other questions about any other debts she had, any other payments she had. He just simply looked at this and he said, you qualify for this much of a loan. Now she kind of looked at me because it was more than what she thought she could afford. And I just shook my head slowly. And so she only asked for what she had originally intended to borrow. So the amount that they often will give is 33 to 40% of gross monthly salary. What you have to think of is in terms of your net spendable income, not gross salary. What you actually have after these other things are removed. Now, what I'm saying is that amount can be way, way too high and put all the rest of your life in a real bondage. Now, the next question is, does it matter what we borrow for? And that answer should be pretty obvious. The next question I have down actually answers that question. Will it give you a return financially? You know, our whole life isn't to be consumed with dollars and cents. But at the same time, it has such an impact on the rest of life that we need to take seriously its impact in the decisions that we make. So Does it matter what we borrow for? Well, if you are borrowing for something that is going to return you financially, well, yes, it can be reasonable and prudent to borrow for it. Now, what do I mean by a return financially? Well, will it increase your income? Will it increase in asset value, like a house or land that may go up in value? Is it a good bargain in that sense? Is it possible that it could reduce your operating costs? And an example in my own experience was the first house I had in Timmins was had electric heat, and electricity was becoming very expensive there, and it was going up and up, and so I figured it out and discovered that if I put in a high efficiency gas furnace, I would recoup the costs in about 4 years. So I did it. And so I didn't have to borrow money for it. I had done the opposite way a few years before. We had decided to start setting aside a little bit as a buffer or savings. It was only a trivial amount, but it just kept getting deducted into a savings thing. And I probably wasn't wise to take it out because I didn't replace it. But I didn't have to borrow for it. But anyway, even if I had borrowed for it, it would have been repaid back in a quick enough time. It would have been make sense. So those are questions to ask. But the problem is that most of the problem with credit, especially with credit cards, is that we're spending it on things that do not do anything for us financially and only put us into more bondage. Now, the question of surety, going back to the Proverbs again, Proverbs 6, there's a number of times in the Scriptures it warns about this problem of surety. Proverbs 6 and 1, my son, if thou be surety for thy friend, if thou hast stricken thy hand with a stranger, thou art snared with the words of thy mouth, thou art taken with the words of thy mouth. Do this now, my son, and deliver thyself. When thou art come into the hand of thy friend, go humble thyself and make sure thy friend. Give not sleep to thine eyes, nor slumber to thine eyelids. Deliver thyself as a roe from the hand of the hunter, and as a bird from the hand of the fowler. Now that's pretty strong language. What's it talking about? Well, surety is providing a guarantee. And this is, in the context here of doing it for a friend, the most familiar example this would be is when son or daughter wants to get their first car and they don't have any equity or anything to sign over as collateral. And so they say, Dad or Mom, can you come and can you co-sign with me? And by you co-signing, you are becoming the guarantor that if son or daughter doesn't keep up the payments, you get to make them. That's quite a privilege of being a parent. So the warning is, watch out. It's not a sin to do this. You may choose to take the risk and accept whatever the consequences are if things fall apart. But it is warning you that you could put yourself in a real problem that you weren't counting on. And so the problem is that we can do this to ourselves as well. And many of us sign those documents when we're signing a mortgage or a loan for something, and we really don't pay attention to some of that fine print about what happens if. Now, I'm not sure exactly what the situation is here. I know there's been all kinds of mess with foreclosures and so on. And but basically, the issue is this. If you sign a mortgage for a property, you need to know that if something happens and you can't make the payments and it has to go back to the bank, do you have any further obligation concerning that mortgage? Or does the property itself, is the property itself the guarantee or the value that they are going to take and they can't take anything more? If you become personally surety, you yourself are making yourself accountable that even if in a downturn of the economy and that property plummets in value and it's now below the value of the mortgage, that you're still obligated to make up the difference if the bank has to sell it at a loss. Now, I don't know what the situation is here, but in some jurisdictions, that's the way it is. And this could happen with real estate. It could happen with other kinds of loans as well. So that's just a caution to be aware of, to know what you're signing for, and to not put yourself in an obligation where you could have unlimited responsibility for payment. Now, on the other hand, there is an issue that I should mention, and that is the problem of bankruptcy. Bankruptcy has become very, very easy. And I don't know what it is here, but I know there have been record bankruptcies the last several years. Every month, basically, is a new record for bankruptcies. There is not the same stigma as there used to be to going into bankruptcy. Now, I personally do not believe that every case of bankruptcy is an issue of covetousness. It could be things completely out of the control of the individual. It could be poor management rather than covetousness involved. But if a person knowingly borrows money intending to go bankrupt, that is clearly covetousness. That is fraudulent as well, a criminal offense. And so, as Christians, this is a really tough one, because basically, as a Christian, we should feel responsible to pay our debts. But I would make a difference if you were foreclosed on and you were willing and trying to repay what you can. Now, again, that's become a difficult issue for some. Now, some simple guidelines for credit cards. I have one, so I'm not one of those that declares that you must not ever own one. But the simple, obvious, excuse me, the simple, obvious thing is to simply make sure you pay it up every month. I don't know if I have ever paid interest on a credit card. As far as I know, I haven't. And I actually use one because it has a rebate feature on it. It's called, it's Citibank Driver's Edge MasterCard. I'm not making a promotion here. But every purchase I make on the card, there's 2% goes towards purchase of a vehicle. And it's not restricted to new vehicles, so I have earned, over the years, I've probably earned about $6,000 or $7,000 on it and used it whenever I have bought a car to throw on it. So it's, I think it's all right to use a credit card to earn some money instead of cost you. But if I start having money owing month by month, that rebate is nothing. 2% is nothing compared to 18%. The problem is that if you allow yourself to start using it and then it becomes a struggle to pay it all off and you start reducing because they have that minimum payment deal, and it's just a trap. If you ever find yourself going that direction, you must stop. You must recognize it's out of control. And so try to pay up every month, make that a law, unless very extreme emergency. keep only one general card. The exception could be if for business use, for specific business expenses. Make sure you limit the total that you put on the card. Learn to distinguish between needs and wants. Pay cash whenever possible. And then get a little more serious about it if you find yourself becoming a slave to your impulses. If you tend to be an impulse buyer, you should leave your card at home or put it in the freezer or cut it into little pieces and put it on a plaque or something like that. If you find yourself running it up to the limits, if you find yourself hiding your purchases from family members, those are all warning signs that you are not in control of it and you need to get rid of it. Now, what about consolidation loans? Consolidation loans are used to get rid of all this high interest credit, put it on a loan, hopefully at a much better interest rate, and get it paid down. That is a good idea on one very important condition. That is that you stop spending as you have been. One couple that I know went this whole route. They had a house. It was what we call a semi-detached house in Canada. I think, I forget just what you call them here, where it's a half house, you know, side by side. And when they got married, he owned at least 75% of it. He had equity of at least 75% of it. Within 3 years, they had burned up all that equity by impulse spending. They had also racked up 4 credit cards to their limit. And so they did a consolidation loan. And guess what? Within about 6 months, they had their credit cards back up to the limit again because they never changed their ways. The next obvious choice was bankruptcy. And they lost everything. And so that's the way it goes if you do not take control. Now, I wanted to at least draw attention to a couple of things on the working budget and the investing at the end of this sheet that we've been working on is really just for a little bit of awareness of the idea of risk and reward, and I really don't have time to look into that. But if you look on page 2 of the working budget, and you'll have to just run through this and see what is involved in these categories and how it's broken down. But I want to give you this one example, at least, of in the middle of the page, of home buying strategies. This is a real eye-opener for a lot of people. And now the interest rates being as low as they are now sort of changes just how dramatic the difference is. And it's always hard to be realistic because real estate values vary so much from area to area. So I don't know if this will look realistic to you or not. But the idea is to try to buy a smaller house first, pay it off, improve it if necessary, and then use that as a stepping stone to a larger house or your dream home or whatever you want as your final home. And this is just an example to show the significant difference of spending the same amount of money and yet getting such different outcomes. So looking at the second one, Bill Big here, first of all, he goes out and he wants to buy his good home right at the start. So he buys a $210,000 home with a $10,000 down payment. So he has a $200,000 mortgage at 4.5% for 25 years. The payment, $1,107 a month. The total cost of the mortgage is $332,100 plus his down payment, the grand total is $342,100. Now, if you were to compare that to an 8% mortgage, you would see a vast difference. The cost would be way, way higher yet again. It would be a more dramatic example even. But in contrast, here's this other fellow who does this in two steps. First of all, he buys a small house for $110,000 with the same size of down payment, $100,000 mortgage at 4.5% for 9 years with a more or less equivalent payment of $1,126 a month. Now, his total cost to do that is $121,000, and with the down payment, it comes to $131,608. And then what he does then is he sells that house, and he buys the house next door to this other fellow. So now they're both going to be in the same kind of a house, side by side. And now that he has his $110,000 down payment, he's left with a $100,000 mortgage at the same interest rate for 9 years. There's a lot of assumptions in all of this, of course. The payment stays the same. When you add it up, it's $121,000 plus the cost of a first home, a grand total of $243,216. Now, the point of it comes to this. In 18 years, he has paid for, you might say, the same house that the other man is still paying for, and he has done it for $243,000 instead of what the other man is going to pay, $342,000. So you can see there's almost $100,000 difference of what he has paid to have that house, and he gets it fully paid in 7 years ahead. And the simple reason is because he is not paying that huge overhang. If you know how interest is charged on a mortgage, it's charged on the whole principal owing, and then you get to pay a little bit of principal. And so if you can start out with a much smaller amount of principal, that big overhang of interest is not nearly so large, and so the principal then is going to eat away at the amount a lot quicker. And so just to give the... complete the comparison. Sam now owns his house debt-free, and Bill still has 7 years to pay, and so Sam invests the same amount, basically, that Bill is paying for 7 years. Now, the possibilities of what he might get on a return, who knows? But just looking at these possibilities from $106,000 to $126,000. So here you have two men now at 25 years of their life spent, of their working life. They each have nice houses side by side, but one has another $125,000 in investments, likewise. Now, is one of these more spiritual than the other? Maybe not. This has nothing to do necessarily with the man's spirituality, or it could have something to do with his spirituality. But all I'm saying in looking at this is that understanding this principle of the cost of interest can help you to be wiser and to be a better steward of what God has entrusted to you. Now, the other big example is in car buying, and really, I'll have to just let you look through that, but purchasing cars is one of the best ways to invest. One of the worst ways to invest. You can't really call it an investment. You can barely pay it off as fast as it depreciates. And because they depreciate fairly quickly, you get to do it again and again and again. So it's actually possible to pay almost as much, sometimes more, for cars in interest on cars through your lifetime than you put into a house. And they're wasting assets. And so, again, we're all paying for the credit binge that as a society we have been on. And so it makes it increasingly difficult for anyone to overcome that. But if you can apply some of these principles and recognize the benefit of contentment, of being willing to sacrifice in the present for the benefit of the future, you will be on your way to improving your circumstances and freedom from the bondage that credit can bring. Shall we pray? Our gracious Father, we thank Thee that Thou art our great shepherd. We thank Thee that Thou art caring for us. But we confess that it is hard for us in such a materialistic world that we are in to be able to distinguish between needs and our wants, and to live with a sense of contentedness and trustfulness and appreciation for what Thou hast blessed us with, and to not be living always with the need to have more. And so we pray that Thou might teach us Thy ways, help us to see past the glamour, the glitter of the material world, and to recognize that true life is really found in the spiritual realm, in the realm of relationships. Our Father, we cry to Thee that Thou would help us to be able to live in freedom and not to be in bondage. We cry to Thee for Thy blessing upon us. We all have struggles in this area, and so we commit ourselves to Thee in our Savior's precious name. Amen.